The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. Last week we had the winter solstice, and I found myself curious to investigate how do we relate to night, darkness, in our practice, and how do we find it in the teachings. So just briefly, observing it in myself, this season of long nights, I'm aware that brings up an additional challenge for me to really continuously fine-tune my energy. You know, that with the darkness, it can kind of start to slide down a bit. Same thing with the clarity of mind. We have to do a little bit more effort, a lot of us, not all of us. So I find that the mindfulness and the practice in general can be a beautiful way to help us deal with these changes that come. Sometimes we may feel depressed and hopeless about, oh, there's nothing I can do, less sunlight just depresses me. And yet, for most of us, we can do something just by bringing this very careful, caring attention of what's in the present moment and bringing curiosity to it, which then in itself brings up the energy. When we really get engaged of what's happening with me, and we manage to get the mind interested, energy arises. And we know that when energy arises, our mood lifts. And there's a whole chain of very positive effects that happens when we manage to just accept what is, unify the mind in investigating, and we go from there, from one positive mind state to the next. So I was looking a little bit in the discourses of the Buddha of how is it that night and darkness appears in the suttas or discourses. And in general, night is considered a propitious time to practice. That's a time that tends to be quiet, that because of the darkness, you are encouraged to go inward, to look inward. So often in the discourses is described how the Buddha and the monks that were his followers meditated throughout the whole night, just stayed up the whole night meditating. When we speak of the Buddha's enlightenment, we speak of the night of the enlightenment. So it happens during the night. And to me, this is not a coincidence. So night in the Dharma, in the teachings, often has either the symbol of ignorance or also of a great potential of what is possible as far as investigating our inner world. So So we can say that the Buddha, in the night of his enlightenment, he brought a radiant mind, heart, to illuminate his inner darkness. For me, a night suggests a time of truth. And truth in the sense that often at night we feel more strongly whatever the results have been of our life, either that we've lived an ethical life or an unethical life, somehow these results, consequences come to visit us at night in thoughts, in dreams, in emotions. So I found a particularly interesting discourse called Fear and Dread, in which this idea of night and darkness appears several times. And in this discourse, the Buddha describes how certain surroundings, such as forests and wilderness, can be particularly challenging because they bring up fear and dread. But it goes a little bit further. It says that those who have practiced unpurified verbal activities or mental activities or an unpurified way of making a living, they are going to be more likely to be assaulted by fear and dread. So then it gives in this discourse a whole list of what are the states that promote fear and dread. And it says, being covetous and full of lust, overcome by sloth and torpor, restless, uncertain and doubting, given to self-praise, subject to alarm, desirous of gain, honor and renown, lazy and wanting in energy, unmindful, unconcentrated, and devoid of wisdom. Just kind of an interesting list, huh? That when these qualities or these states, I should say, are present, that we are more likely to have fear and dread in places like a dark forest when we go practice. For us, it's not necessarily going to be a dark forest, but maybe it's going to be our dark bedroom. So then a very interesting term comes up in this discourse. It said someone who has not learned to train his or her mind through meditation and concentration, when in a dark forest, he will feel that his mind has been plundered. So plundered, I thought, was kind of interesting in that perhaps whatever modicum of composure we have, if it's not secured by an ethical life, it will be robbed from us in a challenging surrounding. So we are recommended to subdue fear and dread in this discourse. And we're recommended to do so through concentration. So the first advice we're given is a very practical advice, which seems insignificant, but it really is not. So say you're sitting meditating and fear and dread comes up. So the first advice is, do not get up and change your posture. So really, although it seems that this is not important, it's huge in the sense that it's telling us something very essential about this practice, and that is have the courage to face whatever it is that comes up in the moment. It doesn't matter if it's unpleasant or pleasant. Just turn towards it. And so you sit. Joseph Goldstein said sometime, if you haven't felt fear in your practice, you haven't really begun practicing. So it's very interesting to practice with fear, to just sit and watch it come up, stay for a while, and if you have the courage to just keep sitting, it'll be like a wave. It peaks at some point and then goes. It disappears. It's not going to stay there forever. So if we have never had the discipline, the inclination to practice, to look inward, to do contemplation, we don't know what we're going to find in our inner world. And so Pablo Neruda, the Chilean poet, says, "One day, in an unknowable place, you will inevitably find yourself, and that, only that can be the most joyous hour of your life or the most bitter one." So this is just another way of saying, you know, this practice is an invitation to meet ourselves over and over again. In this particular sutta of fear and dread, it says that the result of an ethical life and a trained mind results in a mind that is concentrated, purified, bright, and blemished, rid of defilement, pliant, malleable, steady, and attained to imperturbability. That's pretty nice, huh? So when the mind can get to this state, we can direct the mind easily, because it's malleable, towards discovering the truths about this practice. For example, eradicating the mental impurities, knowing how to eradicate the mental impurities would be a very central truth or knowledge in this practice. And then it comes, when we are able to touch into these truths, we get descriptions about darkness. It says, when we arrive to the truth, ignorance then is destroyed. True knowledge arises, darkness is destroyed, light arises. As happens in one who is heedful, ardent, and resolute. So here you see how darkness again is symbolic of the ignorance that can be destroyed once the mind has been purified. So once this mind is purified, it is very beautiful, it says, then the mind will become a refuge for you and for others. I find that a very beautiful possibility, that our own minds could become a refuge for ourselves. So going back to this idea of night being a place where unresolved parts of our lives come to visit us, I wanted to share with you something that I just experienced. I have had a correspondence with a prisoner, a lifer, who this has been going on for 4 years, and we started writing to each other because he wanted to learn about Buddhist teachings, and so we were put in touch with each other. And he is in his late 40s and has been in prison for 27 years. And this year happened what he feared the most, and that is that both his father died and then his mother, and he was not able to see them before they died, because of course he could not leave the prison. So he was terribly upset. Apparently this loss, there's something that was unleashed in him. And he began to have terrifying nightmares. So this man has taught me that the way he learns the Dharma best is through short, very simple stories. So in my letters, I write very simple stories that I make up for him, and I convey some of the teachings, just one teaching here and there. So in his last letter, he wrote that one night he woke up from having these horrible nightmares and he was just paralyzed. He just was in terror. So he shares his cell with other prisoners and he was fumbling around to try to find his flashlight. Once he found the flashlight, he wrote that he was looking for the last letter that I had written to him. So he found the letter, and he wrote the last story that I had written to him. The letter that I had written to him was a letter where I tried to help him deal with the loss of his parents from the perspective of the Dharma. So it had elements of sadness and acceptance about the death of his parents, had an element of self-forgiveness about the pain that he had caused his parents. And it also had the element of a gift that his parents had left for him before dying, and that was of forgiveness, of hope, of strength, and courage. So I want you to imagine this prisoner surrounded by the darkness, illuminating with his flashlight this piece of paper, these words that in very simple terms wanted to communicate the teachings of the Buddha. And not unlike the famous figure in the suttas of Angulimala, the murderer, in this story, I was giving him hope that you can always start again, no matter how huge your crime has been. In these teachings, we are given the gift that every moment can be a new beginning. So in a very simple way, this man recounted in his last letter that upon reading this brief, simple story, that he felt deep peace, like he hadn't felt for a long time, and he was able to sleep soundly for the first time since his parents had died. The poet Wendell Berry writes this short poem, "To know the dark, to go in the dark with a light is to know the light. To know the dark, go dark, go without sight." And find that the dark, too, blooms and sings, and is traveled by dark feet and dark wings. And now I want to share another story, a different story, about bringing another kind of light and darkness. And this story was told by a man that I admire tremendously. His name is Gregory Boyle, and he is a Catholic priest who works in LA with some of the most biggest and dangerous gangs in LA. And he's just written a book called Tattoos on the Heart: The Power of Boundless Compassion. So in this book, he shares the story of a man by the name of Pedro. And as some of you might know, the gang members call each other homie. And so this is what Gregory describes about one of the gang members that he worked with. A homie, Pedro, who works for me now as a case manager, was then a greatly troubled kid filled with a measured rage and resentment. He submerged beneath first heavy drinking and then crack cocaine. Pedro, among the gentlest and most kind-hearted of homies, disappeared, eventually into his own netherworld of substance abuse. He was seemingly oblivious that he had left us at all. Daily, I'd see him and offer rehab. He gently declined with a sweetness that never grew defensive. "Oh, thanks, G, but I'm okay." You never stop asking, and sometimes the no matter whatness prevails. And so it did with Pedro. I drove him to his rehab north of Los Angeles, and he began the long, hard, slow work of returning to himself. 30 days into his stay there, his younger brother, Jovan, enfeebled by similar demons and displaced in the same chemical dependence, did what homies explicitly don't ever do. He put a gun to his head and an end to his pain. Homies, more often than not, just decide to put themselves in harm's way when things turn bleakest. They just take a stroll into their enemy's domain. Gangbanging is how they commit suicide. And any shooter is never going on a mission, foray into enemy territory, intending to kill, but rather hoping to die. Jovan's homies were unfamiliar then with this new language, so direct, bypassing the slow dance with danger that eventually gets you to the same end. I call Pedro, and he is, of course, devastated. But since he's now 30 days sober, he allows the pain passage to his core and doesn't permit the hurt to waste time, languishing in some distant way station. He lets all the sadness in, and this is new. I schedule to pick him up for the funeral and make a point to emphasize that I'll be driving him back right after the burial. Of course, gee, I want to come back here. I make the trek to the mountaintop and feel inadequate, as I always do in accompanying such loss, especially as huge as this one felt. Emily Dickinson writes, "Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul that sings the song without the words and never stops at all. I've come to trust the value of simply showing up and singing the song without the words. And yet, each time I find myself sitting with the pain that folks carry, I'm overwhelmed with my own inability to do much more than stand in awe, dumbstruck by the sheer size of the burden, more than I've ever been asked to carry. Pedro is out front waiting for me, and we greet each other with abrazos and a minimum of words. We hop in the car. Any worry I have about what to say gets punctured by Pedro's insistence to tell me about a dream he had the night before. It's a trip, G. I had this dream last night, and you were in it. And in this dream, Pedro and I are in this large, empty room, just the two of us. There are no lights, no illuminated exit signs, no light creeping in from under the doors. There are no windows. There is no light. He seems to know that I am there with him. A sense, really, though we do not speak. Suddenly, in this dark silence, I retrieve a flashlight from my pocket and push it on. I find the light switch in the room, on the wall, and I shine this narrow beam of light on the switch. I don't speak. I just hold the beam steady and wavering. Pedro says that even though no words are exchanged, he knows he is the only one who can turn this light switch on. He thanks me for happening to have a flashlight. He makes his way to the switch, following the beam. I suppose some trepidation. He arrives at the switch, takes a deep breath, and flips it on. The room is flooded with light. He's now sobbing. At this point, in the telling of the dream, and with a voice of astonishing discovery, he says, "And the light is better than the darkness." As if he did not previously know this to be the case. He's weeping, unable to continue. Then he says, "I guess my brother just never found the light switch." Possessing flashlights and occasionally knowing where to aim has to be enough for us. Fortunately, none of us can save anybody, but we all find ourselves in this dark, windowless room, fumbling for grace and flashlights. You aim the light this time, and I will do it the next, and you hope and you wait for the light, this astonishing light. So going back to the sutta, the discourse of the Buddha, at the end of the discourse, the Buddha is also described as a bearer of light. And this is how it's described. How truly future generations have been shown sympathy by Master Gotama in the manner of one who is worthy and rightly self-awakened. Magnificent, Master Gotama, magnificent, just as if he were to place upright what was overturned, to reveal what was hidden, to show the way to one who was lost, or to carry a lamp into the dark, so that those with eyes could see forms in the same way as Master Gotama, through many lines of reasoning, made the Dharma clear. So Let's take a few minutes. May we not fear darkness and run away from it. And may we learn to practice in the darkness until the path to the light is revealed to us. So thank you very much, and unless you have some comments, questions, we can end early. Thank you.